for the House Committee on Rules for Monday, June 8th. Thank you all for being here and joining us today. I'm going to open a public work session on Senate Bill 671. Erin, would you describe the measure?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 671 requires Oregon Department of Administrative Services to transfer ownership of Blue Mountain Recovery Center and Eastern Oregon Training Center property to the City of Pendleton. It provides specific property and tax lot information for state-owned property being transferred to the City of Pendleton. It requires the Department of Administrative Services provide proof that properties are environmentally clean. It comes to you with no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued on the measure.
Okay, Senator Hansel and whoever else would like to speak on this should come forward right now.
Pendleton City Councilman Chuck Wood, may he join us?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The more the merrier. And Representative Barreto, we let him know that it was coming. I don't know if he's going to be able to make it.
Okay, thank you. Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Hansel, State Senator for District 29. Senate Bill 671 is the result of two emergency board meetings held in 2014. On September 16, 2014, Pendleton Mayor Houck and Regional Solutions Coordinator for the area, Scott Fairley, came before the board to present a strategy on how to mitigate the economic impact caused by the closure of the Blue Mountain Recovery Center in Pendleton. For those of you who might not know what the Blue Mountain Recovery Center was, it was a service that the state provided for folks with mental health issues, and it was closed because of the new facilities that were being built here in the valley. The reason for this was a result of a budget note that was attached to House Bill 5201 during the 2014 session. The budget note directed the state of Oregon to work with the community of Pendleton and local partners to develop a strategy on how to mitigate the economic impact caused by the closure of the recovery center. Further, it asked that the strategy include how the state can invest the resources to mitigate said impact. Based upon the budget note, Regional Solutions began holding meetings with many individuals in Pendleton. One of those in attendance and active participation was former Representative Bob Jensen. Representative Jensen spent a great portion of his time in the legislature trying to find a way to use the location in Pendleton for something other than the problems it was creating. Pipes froze, the roof leaked, and the buildings were falling apart. Their findings included many key aspects. They requested $250,000 to support the unmanned aerial vehicle development at the Pendleton Test Range. This would create up to 350 jobs in the area. They requested $935,000 to demolish the Blue Mountain Recovery Center and that the land be conveyed to the city of Pendleton for industrial redevelopment. They believe, based on existing uses around the property, the site would support about 80 manufacturing jobs in Pendleton. At the time of the closure, DAS was spending over $900,000 annually for operations and maintenance of the recovery center. In addition to that, the group requests $100,000 to demolish 11 buildings at the former Eastern Oregon Training Center site, and that this land also be conveyed to the city of Pendleton for development, to be marked for community college and workforce housing, which has been identified as a high need for the area. After this presentation in September, the emergency board requested Mr. Fairley and Mayor Houck to come back before them in December with a request for what state resources needed to implement the strategy that were not currently available in existing agency budgets. In December, they came back before the emergency board and reported that $1,035,000 was needed for demolishing of the former BMRC building as well as 11 buildings at the former training center. They also requested the land the buildings were sitting on be conveyed to the city. The emergency board granted the finances to demolish the buildings and agreed the land should be conveyed to the city of Pendleton. Shortly after that meeting, it was discovered the emergency board did not have the authority to convey the land to the city. So Senate Bill 671 simply allows for Pendleton to have the land these buildings originally were placed on. Also, it states that DAS and the state of Oregon must convey the land to the city with a letter showing the locations of all buried utility lines as well as a no further action needed on any cleanup. Senate Bill 671 is the last step for Pendleton and the regional solutions to move the project forward, and as DAS and the state no longer have plans for the property. Pendleton, therefore, can develop the land and use it in such a way to stimulate the local economy and create the needed jobs for the regions. It passed out of the Senate on a 29-1 vote, and the no vote, Senator Shields has assured me that he is now fully supportive. I would be more than happy to answer any questions you might have.
Sir.
Thank you, Senator. Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm Chuck Wood, Pendleton City Council, Ward 2. I live at 414 Northwest 4th Street in Pendleton. And I'm here simply today to represent Mayor Houck and our city manager, Rob Corbett, who send their thanks for the opportunity to have the hearing, and with our regrets that they couldn't be here today, we ask for your support of 671 as well. I won't repeat everything that Senator Hansel has said. It's basically been a work in progress for a number of years. As you're aware, the former Eastern Oregon Training Center was closed back in 2013 with the loss of over 200 jobs. In 2008 was EOTC. In 2013, we lost Blue Mountain Recovery Center, which was a 60-bed mental health hospital. This gives us the opportunity to address housing needs, industrial needs we have. One point that the senator didn't include in his comments is we're on the cusp right now of one of the three test ranges in the state for unmanned aerial systems, which has a lot of promise, and this feeds into that project very, very well as well. Again, I thank you all for your opportunity to testify today, and also I'm very happy to respond to any questions.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both for being here. I have two brief questions. Number one, so is the land that is there, is it what's, you know, what we call shovel-ready and ready for industrial development? I would presume. So that's my first question. And then my second question is, does the transfer then waive any liability on the state's part? Is it kind of a free and clear, if something were to come up in 5 or 10 years that we don't know about now, would the state be liable for that? Or is this a full transfer and it's all in Pendleton's hands now?
My understanding is as soon as the buildings are removed, yeah, it's shovel ready. It's ready to go. The second thing is, I think in the agreement there is that it's cleaned up, it's ready to go. Okay. We don't anticipate there's any huge amount of it. Most of the environmental issues are in the buildings themselves, asbestos, lead pipes, this type of thing, and they'll be cleaned up.
Thank you. Mr. Wood, I want to thank you for coming all the way out here. I know it's a long way, and we really appreciate all your work, and please, send that word back to your people back there. And again, Senator Hansel, any final words?
No, thank you. It's just that we made commitments to the local area. This is the final part of it, and it was a big hit economically when the facilities were closed, lost hundreds of family wage jobs over the years. This will, I think, is a good solution. We can now redevelop that land and hopefully bring a lot of those jobs back.
Fantastic. With that, I would accept a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like at this time to move Senate Bill 671 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Gilliam has moved Senate Bill 671 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion passes. We'll have Representative Barreto carry the bill and close the work session. And thank you for joining us here
thank
today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Council.
With that, I'll open a work session on House Bill 3557. public hearing and work session?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we actually do not have anybody signed up to testify on House Bill 3557. So if you wanted to just open a work session, that would be appropriate.
Great.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3557 requires public bodies that receive requests for disclosure of specified personal contact information of public employees or certain other persons to forward copy of requests to affected persons whose information is subject to request or their representatives. Requires public body to delay responding to requests for 7 days. There is an emergency clause on the measure. You have two amendments before you today. The -1 amendment provides civil and criminal immunity to public body or official of public body who discloses information based on its determination that clear and convincing evidence has shown public interest requires disclosure. And you have a -2 amendment that permits public body to recover costs associated with notifying a person whose personal information has been requested and for determining if information submitted demonstrates clear and convincing public interest requiring disclosure, regardless of whether ultimately that information is subject to disclosure. Both of these amendments come to you with no revenue impact, and an indeterminate fiscal impact was issued for both amendments, Madam Chair.
Okay. We have a few amendments to adopt as people had concerns, publishers had concerns. I think the school districts had concerns, and everybody worked to get to a place where people seem to be in agreement. Is that right? Okay. I'm seeing nodding heads, and there's no one here to oppose it. But so if we could adopt the amendments and then have some discussion.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Excuse me. You said people seem to be in agreement in these people, these
I'm
bodies
saying,
that they represent would be what? The media?
Can some come on up and tell me what bodies you're from?
I'd be intrigued to see who all is kind of supportive of it. I'm sorry. But.
Not at all.
Chair Hoyle and members of the committee, Kelsey Wilson on behalf of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association, and we worked with both Melissa Unger from SEIU and with Chris from Multnomah County on the bill and on the amendments, and are supportive of the bill and neutral on the amendments.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Supportive of both amendments?
We are neutral on the amendments but supportive of the bill.
As amended?
Yes. We would support the bill as amended. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Kenmer, for the record, Chris Fick with Multnomah County. I also want to put on the record that the Association of Oregon Counties is also supportive, and we helped craft the -1 and -2 amendments.
Okay.
And what were your concerns specifically?
Liability and the increased cost associated with informing employees and then taking into account their feedback before determining whether it met the clear and convincing evidence threshold for releasing information.
Yes.
Sorry to go on, but this has raised my curiosity a bit, and I'm just trying to understand this bill in comparatively short notice. If I read the -1 amendment, it seems that perhaps a recent incident might be an inspiration for that, and that was the release of emails in the governor's office to the media. And I wonder, is that what that principally addresses, or where does the -1 amendment go? And then similarly, the -2, we've had some recent exceptional requests for information.
Mm-hmm.
And it strikes me that Second Amendment is an effort to try to come to terms with that, and those are my questions. And broader, more in general, where in the heck are these coming from, and what, how will they manage them?
Chair Hoyle, Representative
Thank Kenmer. You for your patience.
Yeah.
Those were not our concerns with the amendments. Information that could be requested from a public body includes social security information, date of birth, things that we fear could be used for identity theft or that could potentially harm our employees if we were compelled to release it or decided to release it. So that's why we're seeking immunity from the repercussions if we are asked to release that type of information. And on the second count, because this bill has an additional requirement that we notify the employee if their information has been requested and take into account their response, we're just concerned that if there were a large public records request, we could incur a lot of costs associated with compiling that information and taking into account the feedback from hundreds of employees and then determining maybe not even to release it and being stuck with the bill for doing so. So that was our two concerns.
Representative Kenemer?
Is there an emergency clause in the bill?
Yes.
Yes. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to figure out who this applies to. There's two different sections. One of them seems to apply to health care workers and home care workers. The other one, I don't know that I understand who it applies to. Section one.
Excuse me, are you talking about the amendments to the bill?
No, I'm talking about
the bill.
I'm talking about the bill.
Thank you.
The amendments are very confusing to me as well, but for a different reason.
Okay.
Can we get an explanation of what section one applies to?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, I don't have the bill in front of me, but this is adding a public interest test to a public records exemption that was passed earlier in the session. And so I think it applies to home care workers, child care workers, volunteers in some capacity. Thank you. But the purpose of this bill is to add back in a public interest exemption so that if the public interest test is met, that there's clear and convincing evidence that it's in the best interest of the public to release this information, that there is an opportunity to do that. And in the bill that was passed earlier this session, the public interest test was not subject to this public records exemption. So that's the purpose of the bill, is to add back in the public interest test to apply to the public employees under this bill.
Okay, so if I could, the point then is to deal with employees and volunteers. And I see on page one, lines 18 through 23, the existing law talks about what that information is and includes a whole bunch of things. Okay, and then the amendment basically says seeking disclosure by clear and convincing evidence that the public interest requires disclosure in a particular instance. In other words, if I understand it correctly, we set up this exemption earlier bill, and now we're adding something that basically says all that's true unless it can be shown that there is clear and convincing evidence that the public interest requires disclosure.
That's correct.
That's essentially what it says.
That's right.
Okay, I understand that part. Now can I ask a question about the amendments?
Sure.
Thank you.
Sure.
There are two amendments. The Dash 1 amendment establishes a Section 4 and Section 5 and moves the emergency clause to 6. But then that's the Dash 1. The Dash 2 does the same thing. I'm assuming the wording is slightly different, but they appear to be otherwise identical amendments. Can somebody help me understand that?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Barnhart, when I looked at them on OLIS earlier, the Dash 1 grants immunity. The Dash 2 explicitly grants local governments the ability to recoup their costs.
Title to recover costs. Okay. All right. Thank you. I think I get it now. Madam Chair, I think what will end up happening if we adopt both of these amendments is that LC will redraft them, and one of these amendments will become Section 6 and Section 7, and the other one will say 3 and 4. This is very confusing because they have the same numbers.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? And I want to thank you for coming up. And, yes, Representative Rayfield.
How does the determination for clear and convincing evidence made? Who makes that determination? What happens if someone disagrees with that determination?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Rayfield, it is the agency that would be asked for the that the public record request would be made to would make the decision whether there was clear and convincing evidence. I think from my publishers, most of the time they say that there is not, and then it goes into the court system to determine if the information is released or not.
Yeah, so just the follow-up. And so the court costs that would be associated with defending something, would that also be a cost that is recoverable under that Dash 2 amendment?
Representative Hoyle, Representative Rayfield, yes, it's the publishers who bear that cost, is my understanding.
Thank you.
Or the requester, not necessarily only a publisher.
Anyone else? Yes, Representative McLean.
Mr. Frick or Ms. Wilson, who's asking for this bill, and what is the problem we're trying to solve?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, it was the newspaper publishers requested the bill after the bill earlier in session was passed to add back in a public interest test into the public employees' public records exemption, so that if we found or had to prove clear and convincing that it was in the public's best interest to release these records, that we would have access to those records. Otherwise, it was a blanket exemption, and that information would not be released at all. So we are asking to add back in the public interest test so that if we can prove that it's in the public interest to release the information, that information gets released.
Yes, Representative McLean.
As a follow-up. Do you know the bill number that took away the public's right to know?
Representative Hoyle, Representative McLean, it was House Bill 3037. I think it's referenced in the bill.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to something that Representative Kenemer sort of touched on, and if I missed it, that's okay. There is nothing wrong with this, so this is not an accusatory kind of question. But to what extent did the current situation of our former governor trigger this bill, in your opinion? Has it been a large part of the discussion, or is it a very small part?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Gilliam, I would say that the newspaper publishers are always concerned about public records exemptions, and there's over 400 on the books, and they always would advocate for at least a public interest test in any public records exemptions. So we've been working on public interest tests for a long time, and the current situation doesn't necessarily have anything to do with why we want to add that back into the statute.
Yes, Representative Kenemer.
I'm not sure exactly how to phrase this. I guess I'm having trouble seeing why it takes 8 pages of bill to accomplish that. And as I tried to read through it, it's a bit tedious, if I may.
Representative Hoyle, Representative Kenemer, we sat with Dexter and worked through a lot of different issues, and this is the way that Legislative Council drafted the bill. So I don't know. Yeah. I don't have a good answer for that.
I asked Dexter to come and thought he'd be here by now, but he is not here. He's just reading the bill.
You're reading the amendments, probably. Yeah. Right.
So we can stand at ease until Dexter gets here.
And there's no one in
There he is.
There we go. We were just mentioning your name, and you walked in the door. Serendipitous.
Mm-hmm. We always sigh when Dexter walks in.
Yeah.
Everyone says
Dexter. There's no one in opposition. How long? Been working on this bill for a while.
Yeah, Representative Hoyle, Representative Kenemer, we have been working on this. I think it maybe dropped a couple weeks ago. It was scheduled last week, and then the concerns of the Association of Oregon Counties and Multnomah County were raised, and so we worked through those issues with them, and now it's back up.
Thank you.
Okay, and did anyone have questions from Dexter about the original bill, or the language, or the pages? Because we can bring them up.
Yes, I'd like to.
Come on up, Dexter, and identify yourself for the record.
Chair Hoyle, members, good afternoon. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Dexter, I guess I'm trying to understand what we're trying to correct, and if you could walk it through in some kind of a short synopsis. I'm not asking for a detailed thing, but I'm just trying to understand what those eight pages of, I use the word tedious reading, involve, because it just, I'm not familiar with this area of law very much.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Kenmer, the bill, which really the guts of it is actually at the end, I think, to address concerns of individuals who either aren't conventionally thought of as say state employees, because they're volunteers, or they're actually individuals who are licensed in like home care workers or child care workers, that sort of thing. And that I think the policy was that those individuals should have notice and opportunity, along with actually regular state employees, to a notice and opportunity to object when there are requests for personal contact information.
And this, but this bill also clarifies what public interest is specifically, so that people can have access to that. That's
well, yeah, Chair Hoyle, it retains the structure that is present in existing law with respect to regular public body employees or volunteers, as you see right at the beginning. This actually is a essentially restoration of what an earlier bill of this session had changed. That information, the personal contact information and the like, is disclosed only when there is clear and convincing evidence that the public interest requires disclosure. That is an existing standard. The earlier bill took that away. This restores that and also extends it to child care workers, home care workers, and I believe there's one other
volunteers.
Yeah, one other class of individuals.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
In the Dash 1 amendment, then, perhaps I misread it. I guess I saw this as also providing protection in, for example, the recent incident where emails of the governor were released to the news. And I guess I'm wondering, does this deal with that issue?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Kenmer, no, I don't believe it does. It just has to do with decisions about whether the disclosure of personal contact information, so conceivably to the extent the governor's, that set of emails that is in dispute right now contain that,
right.
Perhaps, but that would be,
that
pretty,
would be pretty
incidental.
Peripheral.
Yeah.
And also social security numbers or things of that nature, which was your point. Yes, Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So going back and thinking about the bill that we passed earlier that this is attempting to fix, and I presume that was the House Bill 3037, and if I also recall, it exempted child care workers, volunteers, and so forth from their information being disclosed. So I guess with that in mind, I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around the dash ones that provide civil and criminal immunity for the public body or official that determines that their information should be disclosed. I don't know. It just seems odd to me.
Well,
it would seem that we would address that deficiency in a different way than this. But I,
Chair Hoyle, Representative Wilson, let me just frame the issue this way, that the earlier bill actually exempted all that outright. And right. now this bill restores essentially what had been the standard, which is that you can disclose it upon a showing by clear and convincing evidence that it is in the public interest to disclose. The immunity piece is new, and I'm not sure what the policy is behind that.
Do you want to speak to that, Chris?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Wilson. Again, the concern is that should the clear and convincing threshold be met, and we release information involving Social Security numbers, birth dates, et cetera, that if that information is subsequently misused or mishandled and identity theft occurs and financial abuse is perpetrated, that we, as a result of releasing that information in good faith, could be held liable for the source of that data. So that's what that amendment is trying to address and insulate us from.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I think this is a follow-up on Representative Wilson's question, but maybe not. The list in the current law includes residence address, residential phone number, personal cell phone number, personal electronic email address, driver's license number, employer-issued identification card numbers, emergency contact information, Social Security numbers, date of birth, other telephone numbers in the personnel records maintained by the public body that is the employer or the recipient of volunteer services. So there's a whole list of things in there. I'm having a hard time understanding when you would ever accept a public records request for some of this information. I can understand, I'm not sure. I mean, I can understand why there might be a reason why you would release a name, although it doesn't look like name is on the list. But can you give us some examples where you would release some of this information, Social Security numbers? Why would you release Social Security numbers to someone in the public? I can't imagine a reason why you would ever do that.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Barnhart, I think it would be a very rare occurrence that we would even ask for that information. I think that is what is in the exemption that was passed in 3037. That's not the information we're necessarily seeking. We are just adding back in that public interest test. But that's not information that the newspaper publishers would not seek, Social Security number. The only thing from that my publishers have told me is that they may look for a date of birth so that they can verify that it's the correct person whose information they're seeking, but they're not, it's extremely unlikely that they would request the Social Security number of an individual. But that is what is currently exempt under this exemption, and so the public interest test applies to that.
Okay. Could I follow up?
Yes.
Thank you. Now, I guess I'm confused then. I wonder why the bill isn't more limited to the information that is likely to fit that public interest need rather than simply applying to everything. I mean, we have this, and this is a follow-up to Representative Wilson's question because he was asking about about immunity from civil or criminal liability. The more narrowly drafted the bill is, the less likely the issue of the need for immunity from civil or criminal liability occurs, because the guidance would be you don't release any of this other information, but if there is a compelling interest, to do so, you can release that information, that more narrow information, like the date of birth that you've indicated. I'm confused. This bill looks very broad to me, especially in the context of immunizing the public body for an error of that could be a huge magnitude for the individual whose information is released.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Barnhart, let me make an observation anyways, that the starting point in public records law generally is disclosure. Right. And then what you see here in the light phase is what you had previously decided was right. going to be exempt.
What I quoted.
Correct.
Right.
And so now this is allowing disclosure if certain conditions are met of that. And it's a policy choice as to whether you want to, you know, to what degree you want to make it an absolute exemption versus a balancing test where the information can be disclosed upon a showing by clear and convincing evidence. And what you want to put in one basket and what you want to put in the in another is really a policy choice on your part.
Well, if I could respond to that, the point that I think I'm following up on from Representative Wilson has to do with immunization. And it's, what is it, the Dash 1 amendment. The public body erroneously concludes that it's in the public information, public interest to release the Social Security number and does so. But that was an error on its part. It wasn't in the public interest to do that. But there's an immunity from any liabilities for having done that. So that feels like a hole to me in this whole process. That's my comment, Madam
okay,
Chair.
Thank you. Representative Rayfield.
I would just point out, for Representative Barnhart, I mean, I think that in most of these situations, I don't think that there are going to be many instances where there's going to be clear and convincing evidence to release a Social Security number. So I think that's, I mean, to me, I feel like we're getting off on a side point. Well, there may be instances where it does make sense to verify identities, but probably very, very rarely. And so I think with the clear and convincing evidence, which is a pretty high standard, that's not your 50% threshold, that is a higher standard. So it is going to be more difficult to access this information as well.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Did you want to take a break before we adopt amendments?
If you would allow us.
We will recess momentarily.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3557.
Vice Chair Smith-Warner has moved the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3557. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the amendment? Dash 1. Seeing none, the motion passes. Vice Chair Smith-Warner.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3557.
Vice Chair Smith-Warner has moved the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3557. Is there any discussion on this amendment? Any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3557 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Recommendation.
Vice Chair Smith-Warner has moved House Bill 3557 to the floor with a due pass as amended. Recommendation. Is there a discussion? Yes, Representative McLean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm supportive of the amendment. When the original House Bill 3037 was passed, I spoke in this committee on the floor that I thought it was disingenuous for SEIU to have access to information that they acknowledge would be used in campaigns. In fact, they didn't deny that they plan to support the ballot initiatives by the group that they fund called Our Oregon. It's a nonprofit that advocates for raising taxes and progressive causes funded by the public employee unions. So, but clearly they put this, it went too far, and now the newspapers want to have access to some of that information on clear and convincing evidence. But I just renew again my frustration that if the information is important to keep private, then SEIU's campaign and AFSCME's campaign and OEA's campaign arms should not be using this information for their purposes either. Thank you.
Should we do a do I need to do a roll call? All right, any other discussion? Any objections? Okay, seeing none. Motion passes unanimously. And I will carry the bill, close the work session on House Bill 3557, open a work session on House Bill 2178.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2178 requires campaign finance statement to be filed within 2 business days if aggregate amount of contributions equaling or exceeding $2,500 from a single donor is received during 14-day period immediately preceding the election. It does adjust other filing deadlines for campaign finance statements. This measure was originally heard on February 16th. What you have before you today is a Dash 5 amendment. The Dash 5 amendment requires campaign finance statement to be filed within 2 business days after a single contribution of $2,500 or more from donors received or a single expenditure of $2,500 or more is made to recipient. Restores the reporting timeline during the 42 days before election to 7 days for contributions under the $2,500 threshold and all independent expenditures. It also establishes a 15-member task force on campaign finance reform. It specifies the membership, charge, and reporting requirement. It is the Community Services Office of Legislative Administrative Office is charged with staffing the task force. With the Dash 5 Amendment, because we have established a task force, this measure will need to go to Ways and Means. We did receive a minimal fiscal on the measure, but it still needs to go down there to be considered with other task forces that that office and other offices have been asked to staff.
Okay, with that, move to adopt the Dash 5 amendments, and then we'll have discussion. Anybody want to?
Yeah. Madam Chair, I move the Dash 5 amendment to House Bill 2178.
Vice Chair Smith-Warner has moved to adopt the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2178. Is there discussion on the underlying bill with the Dash 5 amendments? And I do want to thank Dan Meek, who sent feedback on a number of iterations of the bill and helped us get to the place where I think it was more consistent with what we were trying to do. He's not here today, but he weighed in a number of times over the past week, and that was very, very helpful.
And he supports the Dash 5,
doesn't he? Doesn't object.
There we go. But thinks they should be adopted is the message. Thank you.
All right.
Yes.
Madam Chair, for the record, could you just say a little bit about Mr. Meek?
Who we represent? He is affiliated with the Independent Party of Oregon and has been consistently come and been interested in election law and transparency for many, many years in this building.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Yes, Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, are we discussing the bill now, or are we simply moving the amendment?
We're discussing the, we discussed the amendment. I mean, we're discussing the amendment, although if you want to discuss the underlying bill with it, that would be fine, too.
Okay. Yeah, I guess a question that I would have for no one in particular or everyone in particular is what problem is this bill addressing in reality? I mean, we go to a lot of effort to do things like this, and I just have to wonder, what is this bill for, and what problem is this alleviating by our supposed adoption of this?
I think this, my understanding is that this is brought forward because at the end of a campaign, people can drop in really large contributions, and even though the timelines are short, they're really not short enough so that you can see in real time who's getting a large amount of money dropped into their campaign. So who are financing campaigns right at the end? So it shortens that period. Secretary of State's office, would you like to speak to the bill at all?
I would appreciate that. I don't live in a world where I am used to getting a lot of contributions at any particular time. Southern Oregon.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Wilson, Rochelle Altman, Legislative Director from the Secretary of State's office. Yes, the problem that the introduced bill was trying to tackle is that large campaign contributions can sometimes be made leading up to an election during the last 6 days before an election, and because there's 7-day reporting requirements currently on the books, those large campaign contributions can sometimes not be reported until after the election. So if we're trying to give voters as much information as possible about who is funding campaigns, the Secretary of State, former Secretary Brown and current Secretary of State Atkins believe this is a way to close a current reporting loophole.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. Okay. Is there any other discussion on the amendment? If not, yes, Representative.
What amendment again?
Dash five.
I have a question on just what it does. If there's a contribution that has to be reported within 2 business days, an expenditure of $2,500 or more is made to a recipient. I don't know what that phrase means. Can you tell us what that, somebody tell us what that means? Who's a recipient?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Barnhart, the recipient would be a candidate or candidate or a political committee that receives the contribution.
But if I may, but the last half of that phrase is, or a single expenditure of $2,500 or more is made to a recipient. I simply don't understand what that phrase means.
Sure. Chair Hoyle, Representative Barnhart, the introduced bill only had a trigger for 2-day reporting in the case of large contributions. And it's my understanding that some stakeholder groups, I believe AFSCME was among them, wanted 2-day reporting to apply to both relatively large contributions and relatively large expenditures. And the Secretary of State's office is neutral on that. We can't speak in greater detail about why that change was wanted. But if a committee made large expenditures leading up to an election, right now there's currently a 7-day reporting requirement, and the Dash 5 amendments would, if the $2,500 threshold is exceeded, then 2-day reporting for large expenditures and large contributions over that threshold would have 2-day reporting requirements.
Okay. I think I understand, Madam Chair. Let me ask the committee administrator. I think the words "from a donor" and the words "to a recipient" are redundant. If they are, then I understand the phrases. Thank you.
Yes. Representative Wilson.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I read this correctly, then there is also a public interest in, if it's reflected by this amendment, there's also a public interest in knowing who the candidate has spent money with at the end of the election as well. And if that's the case, what would gather the attention of the Elections Division as something that would be alarming or inappropriate?
Again, Chair Hoyle, Representative Wilson, the Dash 5 amendments were not requested by the Secretary of State's office.
Just a personal opinion.
Well, I can say when we were drafting the introduced bill, the large excuse me, large contributions were what were of concern to the Secretary of State. We did consider large expenditures and believe that those did not raise our concerns to a sufficient degree that we wanted to impose two-day reporting requirements.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative McLean.
So if you have a PAC that makes independent expenditures, are they required?
They are not.
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, if there is a political committee, any expenditures made by a political committee are not independent expenditures under the statutory definition. A political committee cannot make an independent expenditure.
All right.
Yes.
Then let me ask the question more precise. If under the laws that we have for elections, in a PAC, independent PAC, a PAC that is not represented by a candidate, in other words, it's not my PAC, it's not Rep Hoyle's PAC, it's a union paid for PAC, and they just spent $200,000 on behalf of Representative Hoyle, and and then they have to, they're obligated by law to in-kind her. When are they required to report under this?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, they would face the same two-day reporting requirements.
My office requested the Dash 5s. We were working with Dan Meek with the Independent Party of Oregon because there was the initial bill, and he had some issues that it extended the time for certain things. But in-kind contributions would have the same two-day reporting. Independent expenditures, so C3 doing an educational campaign, then that would be done independent of a candidate. I don't know, Monica PAC, for instance, if they were doing an educational campaign on someone's votes, that isn't specifically done on behalf of your PAC, or isn't specifically done on behalf of my PAC or a candidate, then that would be done separately, and that's an independent expenditure and independent of any of the process. But in-kind contributions, they actually tighten the limits. So, and I think you've spoken to it before, at the end of the campaign cycle, if a group comes in and does paid canvassing, that would now, instead of being a 7-day reporting, it would be a 2-day reporting.
May I follow up questions, please? Mm-hmm. So under the rules, if a PAC spent money on behalf of a representative and was required to in-kind it, how long do they have until they have to report the in-kind contribution to the candidate?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, the ORSs don't distinguish between direct contributions and in-kind contributions. So an in-kind contribution would have the same reporting requirements as a direct contribution to a candidate. So if an in-kind contribution were made that exceeded the $2,500 threshold that is in the Dash 5 and introduced versions of the bill, then the two-day reporting would be triggered.
May I follow up?
Mm-hmm.
So as a follow-up to that, who reports? I understand that the PAC would report their expenditure. Let's say their expenditures to ABC Television to run commercials, and they report an expenditure called ABC Television. Then they would at some point be required to notify the candidate of an in-kind contribution. How long until they are required to report that to a candidate, hey, I just purchased $200,000 worth of television to run commercials to support your candidacy?
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, I believe that it would be 2 days after the expenditure is made, but our Deputy Director for Campaign Services, Brenda Bays, is here, and I will ask her to speak to that question.
Thank you. Representative McLean, they would report the recipient of the in-kind contribution.
Oh, your name. Sorry.
I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Brenda Bays. I'm the Deputy Director for the Elections Division. They would report that in-kind contribution once they have knowledge of it within the two-day period.
May I follow up? Okay, just when you said that they have knowledge of it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let me ask you the hypothetical just to make sure, because I know that once, say, Representative John Doe receives notification that a PAC spent $100,000 for him, he has a two-day, under this bill, two-day reporting.
That's correct.
Okay. What I'm unsure about, and I want to make sure I have on the record, is after ABC Television is purchased to run campaign commercials on behalf of a candidate, what is the legal requirement that PAC report, and then how long can PAC delay in sending the notice to the candidate that the candidate has received an in-kind contribution?
I'm sorry, Representative McLean, are you asking about the original bill or the amendment?
Or current law.
Or yet?
Well, I'd love current law, and then tell me what this bill does to current law. The amended, we've already passed an amendment, right?
No, we have not adopted the amendment
yet. But we're debating it.
We're debating the dash 5. Which is a dash 4 with an emergency clause because there's an emergency.
So I Representative McLean, I just want to clarify. Your question is, the person making the in-kind contributions, how long do they have to notify the person that's receiving the in-kind? Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Just let me look real quick here. So, Representative McLean, the current deadline is 30 days after the contribution is made, 30 calendar days, after the candidate political committee received the updated information. That's correct. So, normally it's 30 days, but of course, up to an election, it's 7 days, election date. During the last 6 weeks of the election cycle.
And what would Dash 5 do for that situation where a PAC has purchased television on behalf of a candidate and now has a legal requirement to notify the candidate of the in-kind contribution?
Would you repeat that again? I'm not clear on that.
Okay. May I read?
Yes, please.
If a PAC purchases directly media for the purposes of promoting a campaign, It has a legal requirement to notify the candidate that they made an in-kind contribution. Under the dash 5, or what is the dash 4 now, what will be the requirement of that PAC in its duty to notify the candidate, who then must disclose that an in-kind contribution has been made?
Representative McLean, Chair Hoyle, I think that we need to follow up with you on that response and get a clear answer for you.
Thank you. Then, Madam Chair, I'd ask to postpone the vote until we have this cleared up. I do believe that one of the ways in which the public disclosure is avoided by certain campaigns is that PACs, independent of the campaign, make in-kind contributions but delay notifying the candidate. Therefore, if your campaign is a recipient of significant in-kind contributions, you actually may have less disclosure than the candidate who actually has campaign money in her account and purchases the media directly. And in that situation, it seems to me that if we want disclosure in the way that has been represented by the proponents of this, then we need to make sure both are included in the disclosure.
Okay, so to that, Mr. Meek is clearly watching on his computer somewhere because he's just sent an email saying current law is the committee making the expenditure is required to notify the candidate or committee via letter or email of the in-kind contribution. Notification must be made not later than 48 hours after the expenditure has been filed in ORSOR. So says Campaign Finance Manual 2014, page 29.
Wow.
So we can still delay that if you would like to, if we can do more research, if that would make you more comfortable to vote on it Wednesday, that would be fine.
Well, Madam Chair, it would, and here's why. If that's true, then that's 2 days, and then the candidate would, I take it, have an obligation here to report within 2 days an in-kind contribution that exceeded $2,500 for a total of 4 days. And so if it's true, then if your campaign is the beneficiary of significant in-kind contributions, then your disclosure is, in essence, 4 days. And if your campaign is dependent on cash purchases, because your money comes from donors who just cut you checks, then it's a 2-day disclosure. And I think even if that's true, what Mr. Meek represented, we have disparity of 4-day versus 2-day, and I'm not sure if.
I don't know how you address that.
Well, I think that may be a simple consequence of in the nature of in kind. I think it's something we have to acknowledge exists.
Mm-hmm. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to approach this subject too from a media standpoint. I have two little radio stations down at Grants Pass, and a candidate would have a hard time spending $2,500 on election day with me. But it could easily happen, and I'm thinking in the case of Portland Television, it could very easily happen. And I know the thrust of this entire proposal is public disclosure and the public knowing what is spent or gained through contribution prior to the election. But there are thousands of dollars placed, and I'm not talking about previously placed, but there are thousands and thousands of dollars placed the night before or perhaps the morning of election day for additional commercials. And, you know, that would fly totally under the radar, even with a tightened reporting window here, seems to me. I don't know how this bill would work with that kind of scenario.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Wilson, you are correct. Under the bill as drafted and the -5 amendment, the most stringent reporting requirements that a candidate or political committee could face would be 2-day reporting requirements. So if a contribution or expenditure were made under the -5 amendments, if that expenditure exceeded the $2,500 threshold, you are correct that the candidate or committee could wait to report until after Election Day.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Just to note that that would be a fairly quiet election. That when I tried to buy a television last time, toward the end of the election cycle, I think even before the ballots went out, there wasn't any available.
Right.
It had been completely absorbed by the GMO and other ballot measure issues. So it's a theoretically interesting issue, but it's a practical matter. I don't think it exists.
It's a lousy campaign.
Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to briefly say that, you know, I think I acknowledge the points that a lot of my colleagues make, and I think the point of this and other greater transparency bills are to, I think you can't legislate to every possible thing that might happen, and so the point of making the deadline smaller and tightening it up is to indeed try to improve that. And so while I respect that, yes, you potentially an independent expenditure could have a 4-day versus a 2-day, well, you're still talking a 4-day instead of the 7 or 9 day that you have now. So I agree with his premise, and I just think that that's why we try to tighten these up, and B, that you cannot legislate for every possible occurrence, because what do they say, money is or water is money, and anytime you close a thing in one place, it figures out how to get somewhere else. So we keep trying to close the places.
So what we can, yes, Representative Wilson.
I'll make it quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that in light of public disclosure and transparency, we're trying to do well here, but one minor point that perhaps doesn't stack up in the minds of many, but as we begin to become so finite as to what we do here, and we spend so much time trying to make things difficult in the face of public transparency, it is going to get to the point one of these days that we won't be able to find anyone to handle our C&E reports except for professionals, because it is going to become too onerous and too troublesome for friends who do this for other friends. The liability is just too high. The complication is just too much. So, you know, perhaps we will one of these days have to go to the quote-unquote professionals to do our C&Es, because friends just won't be able to keep up with us anymore.
And Representative Wilson, I think that's a fair point, and that is the reason that we moved to $2,500 actual and above actual contributions, as opposed to what had been previously presented, I think last session or the session before, which was a $2,500 aggregate, which would be very different if someone got lots of small donations. That's really not what we're on the lookout for. What we're really on the lookout for are those people who dump a ton of money in just at the end of the campaign and really trying to highlight for people where the money's coming from and when it's coming in. But with that said, I think that it's a reason. Yes, Representative McLean.
Make sure I understand, because again, you know, I'm trying to play catch up here a little bit, since we didn't know what amendment would be moved prior to the committee. If I got a donor under the dash 5, which is the dash 4 with an emergency clause, and I believe that's what is proposed to be moved. Is that correct? The dash 5 is there a motion to move the dash 5?
There's a motion to move the dash 5. That will be rescinded so that we can vote on this on Monday and give people 48 hours to actually look at the bill.
Okay. So, on the dash 5, if I had a $2,500 or more, let's say I had a $3,000 donation from my mom, and then and let's say this is in June of an election year, and then in July she gave me another $1,000, what is the reporting timeline on the additional $1,000 in July of an election year?
Representative Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, under both the introduced bill and the dash 5, the 2-day reporting doesn't kick in until the last 14 days before an election. So if we're talking about contributions made back in June or July, that would still be under the 30-day reporting window.
Okay. Okay, so if I might follow up, Madam Chair, thank you. So this is only that window, regardless of what's been contributed prior to that time, is what I'm hearing you say. Because it seems that, well, I'll have to read it closer. Okay, then additional question. If my sister donates to me $3,000, so I'm over the limit, and I report it within 2 days, her next contribution to me is the next day, and she gives me $100. What's the reporting requirement of that $100 if I'm within the 35 days?
For the 14-day.
Right.
Chair Hoyle, Representative McLean, under, let's see. So if we're looking at the Dash 5 amendments, proposed Section 1, Subsection 4A, after that threshold has been met with a first contribution or expenditure, then each subsequent contribution or expenditure, regardless of amount, would also face two-day reporting if we're in that 14-day window leading up to an election.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, with that,
Madam Chair, I move to rescind my motion to adopt the Dash 5 amendment to House Bill 2178.
Representative Smith Warner has moved to rescind her motion. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2178. And unless anybody has any other business, meeting is adjourned. Go in peace. Go in peace. Meeting is adjourned.